Greetings, listeners and friends of RAOTC. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying welcome to this broadcast
for May 2019. I am Bruce, VK3UV.
You know by now that this broadcast is carried on a range of frequencies each first Monday morning of the month, except for January.
However, please don't forget the repeat transmission at night on 80 metres at 8:30pm local Melbourne time.
And Tasmania and via a telecast. These details can all be found on our webpage, www.raotc.org.au. And we again thank all our volunteers who relay this program at the various times.
This broadcast file will be uploaded to our website, www.raotc.org.au, on Sunday, the day prior to our normal monthly broadcast.
Club news.
Our club news today consists of two silent keys, one local, one from overseas. We have been belatedly advised that Eric Day, VK3HYN, RAOTC life member number 1398, became a silent key on the 8th of December 2019. And now an advice from the ARRL is the passing of amateur radio in space pioneer astronaut Owen Garriott, W5LFL. The US astronaut who pioneered the use of amateur radio to make contacts from space, Owen Garriott, died on April the 15th at his home in Huntsville, Alabama. He was 88. Garriott's ham radio activity ushered in the formal establishment of amateur radio in space, first as SAREX, the Shuttle Amateur Radio Experiment, and later as ARIS, Amateur Radio on the International Space Station. We pause now for a few moments in memory of our two silent keys, Eric and Owen. Thank you. Our main talk this month reflects the wartime efforts of our Coast Watchers and is a fitting tribute to those brave soldiers, which was commemorated in the Anzac Day services held only a few days ago. So here is Clive, VK6CSW, to tell us about them.
How the Coast Watchers Turned the Tide of the Pacific War. This article was first published in the Australian newspaper on the 11th of February 2018. Ex-Australian Imperial Force Sergeant James Burrows, now 93 years old, served 4 years, including 2.5 years as a signaller coast watcher in M Special Unit of the Allied Intelligence Bureau, and 9 months with the US 7th Fleet Amphibious Landing Force. He spent 10 months in enemy-occupied territory, overlooking Rabaul. Burrows is the last signaller coast watcher survivor in Australia. The Australian coast watchers brought the tide of Japanese invasive successes to a shuddering halt when two watchmen spotted and reported an impending invasion fleet of 5,500 Japanese troops. The Coast Watchers' observation was pivotal as it precipitated the Battle of the Coral Sea of May 1942 and stopped the invasion of Port Moresby. United States Admiral William F. Halsey would later state that the Coast Watchers saved Guadalcanal and Guadalcanal saved the South Pacific. In early 1941, 10 months before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the Australian government set up the unpublished Malay Barrier and deployed a series of bird defence forces on the islands north of Australia, the Sparrow Force on Timor, Gull Force on Ambon, and Lark Force at Rabaul. Tragically, these undermanned and under-equipped forces were totally outnumbered by the superior Japanese invasion forces that swept south after Pearl Harbor, incurring huge losses for Australian troops. The first of these invasions occurred on January the 22nd, 1942, just 6 weeks after Pearl Harbor, when the Japanese invaded and occupied Rabaul, killing and capturing 73% of the token Australian force left to defend it. 1,053 of these prisoners of war became casualties in Australia's largest marine disaster of the war, when an unmarked prison ship named Montevideo Maru was sunk by a US submarine. The founder and commander of the Coast Watchers, Eric Felt, explains in his historic book, The Coast Watchers, that in late February 1942, after occupying Rabaul, the Japanese dispatched a force to occupy Ley and Salamaua, Buka Passage, and the Shortland Islands. Then in May, they essayed to capture Port Moresby from the sea, at the same time occupying Tulagi. Japan's ongoing effort to strengthen the offensive position of their empire in the South Pacific meant that Port Moresby was a primary target. According to James P. Duffy in his book War at the End of the World, Port Moresby was Japan's strategic goal. The MO Carrier Striking Force, as it was codenamed by the Japanese, intended to isolate Australia and New Zealand from their ally, the United States, in preparation for the Japanese attack on Australia. However, fortuitously, an Australian coast watcher on the Solomon Island of Bougainville provided the first news of Japanese movements when he sent his message on the 2nd of May 1942 that a large force of enemy ships was sailing south towards Tulagi. A second, similar dispatch was made later the same day by another coast watcher on New Georgia. Both coast watchers transmitted their sightings to headquarters at Port Moresby, which relayed the message. 2 days later, the coast watchers' warnings enabled the Allied forces to meet and vanquish the invasion fleet of the Imperial Japanese Navy in the Battle of the Coral Sea, which was fought from May the 4th to May the 8th, 1942. This was the first naval repulse of the Japanese following their series of conquests as they moved from the northern to the southern hemisphere. As Duffy records, the most important result of this historic battle was that it averted the invasion of Port Moresby, with all it portended for the safety of Australia and the future of the war. Moreover, he notes, never again would an enemy fleet attempt to invade that vital port city. After Japan's defeat in the Battle of the Coral Sea, their battered and bruised invasion forces limped back to Rabaul, thus saving Port Moresby from the walk-in, capture and occupy fate which had been suffered at Rabaul, Timor and Ambon. Immediately following the Coral Sea battle, Japan and the United States fought a six-month-long battle of attrition for control of Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands, during which time the Americans came perilously close to defeat. Such a defeat would have been catastrophic for Australia. Fortunately, the Australian Coast Watchers played a vital role in a key victory, the ultimate American success at Guadalcanal. Coast Watchers regularly sent two-hour warnings of bombers with supporting fighter squadrons. Such messages would be sent from their campsites in the enemy-held jungles of New Britain, New Ireland, and Bougainville to the US authorities on Guadalcanal and the Australians at Port Moresby. These alerts saved countless lives, with planes up in the sun ready to pounce, the Navy's battleships on battle stations, and their land forces with their anti-aircraft weaponry ready and waiting for the Japanese attacks. These warnings also enabled the US forces at Guadalcanal to defend hard-won territory, which was of enormous strategic value. The official acknowledgement by five-star US Admiral of the Fleet, William F. Halsey, was brief and poignant. The Coast Watchers saved Guadalcanal, and Guadalcanal saved the South Pacific.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia.
A memorial recognising the role of the Coast Watchers stands in Honiara today. In essence, if the Coast Watchers had not routinely signalled their warnings by Morse code, such as those mentioned above, the consequences would have been dire. Firstly, the capture of Port Moresby by the Japanese would have virtually severed US support for Australia, and, using Port Moresby as a base, Japanese bombers would have been able to bomb Cairns, 525 miles away, Townsville, Mackay, Rockhampton and Brisbane, 1,297 miles away, and block the eastern sea approaches to Darwin, only 1,126 miles away, thus opening the gate for the invasion of Australia. Had the Coast Watchers not alerted the Allies to the impending Japanese attack, Australians would not have been able to launch their Port Moresby offensive and thwart Japan's thrust towards Kokoda. This offensive was crucial as it protected the operation base of courageous forces fighting in New Guinea, who would later fight on the Kokoda Trail, and successfully repel the Japanese from their Buna, Gona, Leh and Sanananda occupations. Subsequently, the combined forces of the US and Australia drove the Japanese from their strongholds at Leh, Salamaua, then Finschhafen, Sidor, Madang, Aitape, Wewak, Hollandia, Biak, Wodka and Moratai. If it weren't for the Coast Watchers, the Allied Supreme Commander, General Douglas MacArthur, would have been constrained to defending the Southern Hemisphere disasters of Guadalcanal and Port Moresby. MacArthur would have therefore been prevented from redeploying his forces, who were instrumental in their successful island-hopping campaign north of the equator. MacArthur's troops managed to reach and occupy Tinian Island, where they launched the atom bombs that ended the war with Japan. Thus, the Australian Coast Watchers turned the tide to destroy Japanese General Tadao Araki's aim to be supreme in Asia, the South Seas, and eventually the four corners of the world. The role of Coast Watchers at critical points in the war was also acknowledged by Allied Commander-in-Chief General Douglas MacArthur, who stated in a foreword to Eric Felt's book, "They are officially credited with being a crucial and decisive factor in the Allied victories of Guadalcanal and Tulagi, and later on in the operations of New Britain." Apart from their vital intelligence-gathering role, however, the Coast Watchers also rescued 75 prisoners of war, 321 downed Allied airmen, 280 sailors, 190 missionaries and civilians, and hundreds of local people and others who had risked their lives for the Allies. One of those rescued was U.S. Navy Lieutenant John F. Kennedy, whose PT-109 patrol torpedo boat was carved in two by a Japanese warship and destroyed in the Solomon's waters. After the sinking, the lieutenant and his crew reached Kolombangara Island, where they were found by Coast Watcher Sub-Lieutenant Reg Evans, who organized their rescue. In 1959, a memorial lighthouse was erected at Badang on the north coast of Papua New Guinea to honour the Coast Watchers. The memorial plaque bears the names of 36 Coast Watchers killed behind enemy lines while risking their lives in the execution of their duties. The plaque also bears this inscription: "They watched and warned and died that we might live." A footnote: this recording was made in early February 2019, at which time Coast Watcher James Burrows, now aged 95, was still very much alive and still very active. Good on you, James.
Thank you, Clive, for that absorbing and memorable report. Now, following on from that, here is Ian, VK3JS, to tell us a little about the impact of World War II bombing. Thank you, Ian.
It has to be said that war is an awful business. Anybody who has ever been caught up in one knows this only too well. In early October, I came across an article in Cosmos magazine which made a comment about the Second World War, albeit from an historical perspective, but in a way that we would never have thought about at the time, and only historians would perhaps think about in the present day. The article is from Nick Carn, C-A-R-N-E, a science writer based in Adelaide, and this is what he has to say. Allied bombing in Europe during World War II sent shockwaves through the Earth's atmosphere that were detected at the edge of space, a new study has found. Researchers from the University of Reading in the UK estimate that each of more than 150 raids released the energy of at least 300 lightning strikes and say the impact significantly decreased the electron concentration in the upper atmosphere. This is thought to have heated the upper atmosphere, enhancing the loss of ionization. Quote, "The sheer power involved has allowed us to quantify how events on the Earth's surface can also affect the ionosphere," end of quote, says meteorologist and co-author Chris Scott. "The ionosphere is important to modern technologies such as radio communications, GPS systems, radio telescopes, and some early warning radar. It is unclear to what extent radio communications during the war were affected." In their study, which is published in the journal Annales Geophysicae, Scott and colleagues examined daily records collected from between 1943 and 1945 at the Radio Research Centre in Slough, just west of London. The name of that town is spelt S-L-O-U-G-H and pronounced Slough. Sequences of radio pulses over a range of shortwave frequencies were sent 100 to 300 kilometres above the Earth's surface to reveal the height and electron concentration of ionisation within the upper atmosphere. The strength of the ionosphere is known to be strongly influenced by solar activity, but is also far more variable than can be explained by current modelling. Although the London Blitz bombings were much closer to Slough than those in Europe, their continuous nature and a lack of surviving information has made it difficult to assess their impact. However, there are detailed records of the Allied raids, and these reveal that the four engine planes routinely carried much larger bombs than the German Luftwaffe's two-engine ones could. Historian and co-author Patrick Major says the crew involved in the raids reported having their aircraft damaged by the shockwaves, despite being above the recommended height. Quote, "Residents under the bombs would routinely recall being thrown through the air by the pressure waves of air mines exploding, and window casements and doors would be blown off their hinges," he says. Continuing the quote, "There were even rumours that wrapping wet towels around the face might save those in shelters from having their lungs collapsed by blast waves, which would leave victims otherwise externally untouched." End of quote.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. Now, here is something a little different. Many of us have varying views on wind farms. So here is Ian again to tell us a bit more about them. Thanks, Ian.
Here's a little article that appeared early in December in Cosmos magazine from researcher Samantha Page. It is not intended to be political or to present any particular point of view, simply to give an insight into research into technology which is currently in use in our community. It is entitled, "For Wind Farms, a Bit of Separation is a Good Idea." The wake from a wind farm can extend 50 or more kilometres, potentially costing downwind farms millions in revenue. That's according to a new case study appearing in the journal Nature Energy that analyses the impact of an upwind farm in Texas, United States, on its downwind neighbour. The research reveals that the downwind farm reduced 5% less energy on average because of the wake from the upwind facility, decreasing revenue between 2011 and 2015 by up to an estimated $3.7 million American dollars. Quote, "Using two different scientific techniques, we demonstrate that wind farm wake effects are real, discernible, and arise from clearly understood physical processes," end of quote, write the author, led by Julie Lindquist of the University of Colorado, Boulder. Quote, "Again, these differences in wind power generation due to wakes have significant economic and environmental impacts," end of quote. In addition to the lost value of the generated power, the downwind farm offset roughly 111,000 fewer tons of carbon dioxide between 2009 and 2016 than it would have if it were not in the wake of the upwind farm. Wind farms are generally built along wind corridors and in close proximity to major transmission lines, the authors write, which increases the likelihood for overlapping wakes. Wind energy has grown significantly in the past decade. For instance, 10 years ago in the US, it accounted for less than 1% of electricity generation. In 2016, it topped 6%. That growth has come with a significant financial investment. According to the American Wind Energy Association, developers in the US have spent more than $145 billion on projects over the past decade. As the authors note, regulation over wind wakes from wind farms is non-existent in the US, despite the clear financial implications. They call for additional study and public policies that could help prevent legal complications in the future. Quote, "The failure to recognize the issue and predictably provide solutions for conflicts may raise the cost of wind energy and thereby slow development," end of quote, they write. Continuing the quote, "Given ongoing increases in global wind development, we highlight the need to understand physical, economic, and legal interactions between wind farms to ensure sustainable development and stewardship of wind resources." End of quote.
Our broadcast would not be complete without our usual monthly joke. So here was this month's effort. A former sergeant in the Marine Corps took a new job as a high school teacher. Just before the school year started, he injured his back. He was required to wear a plaster cast around the upper part of his body. Fortunately, the cast fit under his shirt and wasn't noticeable. On the first day of class, he found himself assigned to the toughest students in the school, the smart punks. Having heard that the new teacher was a former Marine, were leery of him, and he knew they would be testing his discipline in the classroom. Walking confidently into the rowdy classroom, the new teacher opened the window wide and sat down at his desk, when a strong breeze made his tie flap. He picked up a stapler and stapled the chai to his chest. Dead silence. The rest of the year went smoothly. Thank you for listening. This now concludes our session for this month, and we shall be back with you on Monday, the 3rd of June, 2019. Until then, keep well and smiling. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying 73 and listing now for any check-ins and callbacks.